You are listening to the INCJ podcast, conversations about international criminal justice.
Good afternoon, everybody. Welcome to the third event produced by INCJ and the Probation Institute. Both initiatives, organisations, welcome members and contributors from across the globe. So welcome, everybody. The planning for this event has been in the making for a couple of months now, and I'd like to extend my thanks for the invitation to chair this session to some close colleagues that have been working to put this series together. That's Helen Schofield from the Probation Institute, got John Scott from INCJ, Professor Lorraine Gelsthorpe, Professor Dave Ward, and the superstar, Dr. Rob Watson, who puts all this magic together for us. So thanks to all of those colleagues for this invitation. Following this event, we plan to do a follow-up to today's webinar. And that will take place on the 17th of March. People are welcome to continue to book into that. Today, I have the great pleasure of welcoming some colleagues who work hard in broadly digital justice, particularly digital prisons and community settings, probation settings, and explore this topic, this very broad and diverse topic in their research. Our first presenter, Dr. Bianca Reisdorf, will be telling us some of her thoughts and experiences and reflections on her extensive work on digital rehabilitation. And I would like to say that Bibi and her colleague were the originators. The idea of digital rehabilitation was defined beautifully by Bibi. So I think we're in digital rehabilitation. We're with digital rehabilitation royalty today. So Bianca will go first. Next, we have Sarah Ellison Davis, Dr. Sarah Ellison Davis, and Glyn Davis from Breaking Free, and they will talk about their service that they deliver both here in some of our prisons and community settings, both here and abroad, and will reflect on their extensive research. And again, these people are significant shapers in terms of providing evidence bases for this work. We then have a pre-record from Dr. Carolyn McKay. She's based in Australia, the University of Sydney, who reflects on her recent work as well with respect to remote hearings. And then we'll have some time at the end to have a discussion and reflect on what our colleagues have presented today. So please do put your comments or questions into the comments box, and I will try my best to field those questions in a reasonable way. So Bianca, are you there? And do introduce yourself better than I have.
Thank you so much, Vic, for the really kind words. I don't think I've ever been referred to as royalty, so I will take it. Thank you so much. I will share my slides. Can you confirm for me that you can see them?
Yeah.
Wonderful. They're in the wrong order. There we go. Excellent. Well, thank you. And so what I would like to do today is share with you a little bit about the background of, you know, what is digital rehabilitation? Why is digital literacy important? And then my own work on this and how it relates to what we can learn globally and maybe what kinds of things are more context specific. So for those of you who have maybe not learned a lot about digital literacy before, or are new to the field, or just getting interested in the field, in our technology dependent societies, especially in the global north, we are very dependent on those technologies, the internet, digital devices, AI now, of course, and lack of access skills and digital opportunities are disadvantaging people. And so at this point in time, the internet is not a luxury anymore. It really is a utility that you need to be able to fully participate in society. And so the way that digital opportunities are available to people is not equal. So those who are already better off have more access, they usually have higher skills, they have more usage, and they also benefit more from using the internet. So it's different levels that we talk about when we talk about digital divides or digital inequalities. And the other aspect of that is that these inequalities are sequential and they compound one another. So there's a lot of research on digital inequality in general, and that kind of research is kind of the background on which I am building my own work. The other really important part of this is that those who are most likely to experience digital inequity are the same exact demographics that are more likely to be incarcerated. So a lot of my research, or almost all of my research, has been situated here in the United States, and then also in Western and Northern Europe. And so when we talk about people who are digitally not as advantaged, and those who are more likely to be incarcerated, we're talking about low-income communities. We're talking here in the States about communities of color. We are talking about people who maybe have lower educational qualifications and so forth. And so this overlap between those two groups, so the people who are experiencing digital disadvantage and the people who are more likely to incarcerate, that overlap is really important. The other thing is that when people are coming back out of prison sentences or jail sentences, they experience something that I call supercharged digital exclusion, because there is digital deprivation during incarceration. And so this digital deprivation essentially then supercharges the digital exclusion that people experience when they come back out. The other aspect is the fast-paced nature of technology. So, you know, 3 years ago, we weren't really talking about AI. Now it's everywhere, right? Everyone talks about it. A lot of people are using it. And so these small changes that happen at a fast pace really affect people. So often when I talk to people about my work, they say, oh, you know, but if someone's just in for like a year or 2 years, it's not that big of a deal. It is still a big deal because of this fast-paced nature of what we're looking at. And other colleagues in this field have found really severe consequences for people who were incarcerated when they come back out. So, for example, colleagues from Kansas have found that incarcerated people or formerly incarcerated people are a lot more likely to become victim of online scams, of fraud, identity theft, all those really big, not great things that can happen to you online, because they have less experience online and they are just more likely to also be in a situation where they're more desperate sometimes to find work or to find housing and then fall victim to those kinds of scams. And then Gurusamy also looked at the facet of the stickiness of the criminal record. So because of the digital world, because of all the technology that we have available, one thing that is happening to people is that their criminal record is essentially available everywhere. And so even if they've served their time, they have finished parole, and you know they're trying to start a new life, people are really struggling with that being available. Their neighbors might look it up, new friends, potential employers, everyone can find their record. And even if you know how to have it removed, it's a very complicated process. It can take a long time. So that's another aspect of that work. So my own work in this field has spanned three different studies. The first one was a scoping study of three different prisons across Northern Ireland and England in 2015 that I conducted together with Yvonne Jukes. And so for that study, we were invited to different prisons that were kind of at the forefront of using the internet. And we were able to talk to currently incarcerated men and women, some of the administrators and some of the correctional officers as well. We then conducted a study in the United States. So that was when I lived in Michigan, and we did a study with 73 returning citizens. Most of them were men, and all of them had just returned from prison in the previous 3 months of the study taking place. And then the last set of data that I'm basing today's talk on is a pilot study with 28 currently slash formerly incarcerated men. So we started talking to them when they were incarcerated, and then continued talking with them after they came back out. And that started in 2020 in January and was disrupted by COVID. Unfortunately, we were able to follow up with quite a few of them, but unfortunately not all of them. And so these participants, that was the first study where we were able to look at an actual intervention. So participants took digital literacy classes. It was a very short, very limited class. It was only 10 hours overall during their time in jail. And then they received a laptop together with their belongings on their release date. And we were able to collect data before and after their classes, and then also post-incarceration. So what we found out overall is that there are various barriers that people are facing post-incarceration. So there is an access barrier to digital devices and the internet, of course, during incarceration, but then also post-incarceration. And really important here to mention is here in the United States, prison tablets have become incredibly popular. And so a lot of people think it's kind of almost like a gateway drug, for lack of a better term. So it allows people to use a digital device, but the tablets are very different. They're, of course, locked down. They're preloaded with content. And so the use of those tablets is quite different from what we would be able to do on the outside. So it gives people somewhat of a glimpse into using digital technologies, but it's really just a glimpse. We also saw that most of our participants had smartphones post-incarceration, but very few computers. The laptop study, so the final study that I just mentioned, provided that laptop, and it made a huge difference in people's lives in terms of what they were able to do, what they felt comfortable to do. And so that was a really interesting result that we were able to find, that if you provide people some technology, they can do different things than they could do on a smartphone only. We have a skills barrier, of course. So a lack of training during incarceration leads to a lack of skills upon return. And so again, I want to mention here the tablets that are a step in the right direction, although I can talk about tablets for a whole hour and the problems with those tablets. The other problem is that even the facilities that had any training available, the quality was extremely dependent on the instructor, on what the facilities had available in terms of technologies, how old the computers were, et cetera, et cetera. And I'm happy to tell you more anecdotes from the data that we collected on that in the Q&A. The heartening thing that we found in that final study that was disrupted by COVID was that even that really short basic training provided people with overall increased skills and confidence. So the 10 hours were really focused on very basic skills, but we asked questions about all sorts of more sophisticated skills. And interestingly, people felt more confident in the more sophisticated skills, even though they didn't learn those skills. So it just provided an overall boost of confidence to people to really think, okay, you know, if I can learn this, if I can do that, then maybe I can also do this other thing. And a lack of training had a really big impact on people. So people who came out with no training whatsoever were really struggling post-incarceration. Support was interesting because it was available mostly to those people who had a really strong support network. So close family ties, a strong circle of friends. And so those were the people who had more ability to learn these things, got more support from their family and friends in, you know, encountering these new technologies or to them new technologies, and then also had higher skills overall. So when we think about different groups and what we learned about different groups, we found that younger returning citizens were struggling less. And so this was also often tied to sentence length. So a lot of the folks who were younger served sentences that were between 2 and 5 years rather than, you know, folks who had spent 20 plus years in prison. We had several participants who had spent 30 or 40 years in prison. So really, really long sentences. And so that had a huge impact on whether people were able to kind of get used to those new technologies quicker than other people. We did not find huge differences between men and women, aside from women often having more support. So women more often mentioned working with other people in their family, asking for help, asking their kids for help. Men also described this, but to a lesser extent. And interestingly, here in the United States, race is usually a big factor in a lot of things that we look at. But from what we could tell, race itself did not make a big difference, but the available resources did. So whether someone had stable income, educational qualifications, whether they had secured a job post-incarceration, and then also their family ties were really important. So the other aspect I want to briefly mention here is the human labor of digital inclusion in the criminal legal system, because a lot of the results were really affected by the instructors' investment. So those people who told us they had classes told us hugely different stories. Some people said, you know, our instructor gave us a book about how to use a computer and vanished into the next room and we never actually touched a computer. And then other people said, our instructor was amazing. They, you know, brought in... So the classes... None of the classes we heard about had access to the actual internet. So instructors were tasked essentially with trying to bring the internet in, but in an offline version. And so in our scoping study, for example, we met with a few instructors who would pull things on a CD-ROM and bring it in because that's how all the computers were. And so they essentially would take screenshots of, you know, what the internet looks like, what Google looks like, and then show the incarcerated people that they were working with. So outdated equipment was a huge issue, but then also the instructor's investment. So motivation, essentially. The other thing that we encountered quite a bit is the dichotomy of prison staff versus the warden or governor of the institution. So even if there was buy-in from the higher-ups, if there was a lack of buy-in from the people who are working on the ground with the incarcerated people, that was a big issue. And there was also an issue of training. So if people who are actually, you know, working with incarcerated people on a day-to-day basis don't know how to use those technologies, let's say a computer or a tablet, so if they themselves have lower digital literacy, then that can have an effect on how well incarcerated people can use those technologies if they have those classes or if they have prison tablets available. I already mentioned the false assumptions about prison tablets, that people really think, oh, you know, this is kind of like the solution to the problem. It's not, for various reasons that I'm happy to go into in the Q&A. But the biggest thing for me in this is, it's the same idea that we often have about digital opportunities in general, that people say, oh, if you just give them a device like a computer or a tablet or what have you, they'll just learn it by themselves. And that's one of those problems. If we don't address the second step, then the first step is somewhat useless to a point. And then, of course, the general organizational conditions of digital maturity or readiness of the actual facility is very important, and the entire system as well, right? So here in the States, we have state systems, we have state prisons, we have county jails, we have federal prisons, we have private prisons. So all those are different organizations, and many of them have different levels of willingness and readiness to introduce technologies in general to their day-to-day operations, but then also provide those kinds of opportunities to the people that they're serving, the residents of the prison or the jail. And then the other aspect is whether the facility or the system, the state system, county system, whichever it is even focusing on rehabilitation as their primary goal. So that's another aspect here that we need to think of. And that kind of brings me to some things that are translatable, some things that are not translatable. So again, I want to highlight that my data are from Northern and Western Europe and the United States. So I can't speak to anything that's happening in the global South, unfortunately. The thing that I also want to mention is my data are by now almost dated, especially with AI. But what I've been seeing, and that somewhat concerns me, is from other colleagues or things that I get to peer review before they come out for publication, that even the newer data, everything is the same. So we hear the same issues over and over again. Returning citizens in 2026 are facing the same issues that they were in 2020, that they were in 2018, that they were in 2015. And so that gives me pause and that gives me concern, because it seems like we're still not really at the point where we're addressing this issue. Some of the things that are translatable are the recognition of the importance of digital technologies. So if we can bring that to the higher ups and then also to the staff itself, that is would be a really good step to take globally. And then the willingness to engage with the digital technologies would hopefully come with that importance of using those technologies. And then also highlighting the importance of rehabilitation versus punishment. So that's, again, something that we can hopefully translate across the globe. But I also want to mention that it is not currently the same. So especially the emphasis on digital, so how much emphasis or importance is placed on digital versus, not the human rights focus and the rehabilitation focus. So those currently differ by cultures, especially here in the United States. We still have a model that focuses on punishment. Again, if we go to the Scandinavian model, it's more focused on rehabilitation. And then the same is true for resources and infrastructure. So digital rehabilitation inside facilities and also outside facilities post-incarceration requires robust electricity, internet access, devices. And so if that is not available, then that's a real problem for allowing those who are incarcerated to actually learn about digital skills and get used to it before they come out. So with that, I will happily take your questions after the other speakers. And thank you so much.
Thank you, Bibi. That was a wonderful overview of your project. So thank you so much for that. As you said, we'll come back to some questions. As you was talking, there were some questions that were put in the chat, which are important. And I've written down lots of notes. We'll move ahead to then Sarah and Glyn. Hello, both. Thank you so much for presenting today and accepting our invitation. I'll let you introduce your work and your good work with Breaking Free. So thank you both.
Thanks, Vic. Sorry, I'm just trying to set up the slides. It's not allowing me to do a slideshow. Hang on a minute. Resumed. Let me just try. Sorry, the PowerPoint's not playing ball at the minute. Okay. Can you see the slides?
Yeah. Yes.
You can.
Beautiful. Oh, thank you.
Is it full screen? Is it slideshow?
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Brilliant.
Yeah.
Excellent.
Yeah. Yeah. Thank you, Sarah.
Brilliant. Okay. So, sorry. Is that still a full slideshow view? Yeah. It's just.
Yeah.
Looks a bit weird. I'm like, okay, I'll leave that.
Yes.
Thanks everyone for attending today. So we're going to be talking. I'll actually go back to the title slide. We're going to be talking to you about our digital application, Breaking Free, which is a digital treatment for substance use disorders that we deliver in prisons. Just before we start, we'll just briefly introduce ourselves. So I'm Sarah Ellison Davis. I'm a psychologist, been working in research for about 20-something years now. And I've been with the Breaking Free team for about 14 years, working as research director. And Glyn, do you want to go ahead?
No, it's just to say we're still stuck on the front slide, I think.
Oh, sorry, I'll tell you what.
Just by way of introduction, I'm Glyn. I'm the Service Development Director with the Breaking Free team. Perfect, thank you. And I have an academic background in criminology and criminal justice and started working within prisons as a drugs worker sort of 25 years ago, when treatment was quite different to how it's become today, but I've been part of the Break Free team since its inception 15 years ago, which has been developing the interventions that we're going to talk through this afternoon.
Oh, sorry, I'm trying to be fancy. I've got two screens going at the minute, but hopefully that should be working now. So, Glyn, I think you're going to start.
Yeah, brilliant. Thank you. So just to introduce Breaking Free generally, we're a multidisciplinary team. We're a relatively small team of kind of about seven individuals at the moment, but a combination of kind of clinical psychologists, behavioural scientists, as well as the tech team that have helped to develop the interventions. We've been developing Breaking Free since 2010. So during that time, we've been introducing the programme, evolving it and iterating it based on feedback from individuals using the programme as well as organisations implementing it. And we actually created the prison version of the programme back in 2013 when we became aware of Virtual Campus being introduced across the England and Wales prison estate as the educational platform. Now, since that time, we have been working in lots of different treatment settings. In terms of the UK as of today, we're in about 25 prisons where the programme is being delivered in a relatively small capacity, where it's supervised sessions with groups of individuals using the programme via tele-recovery and visionable laptops. But we have just started to go population-wide using secure tablets in prisons like Millsike in Five Wells, working with Socrates BT and Made Purple, as well as kind of starting to go population-wide with the PIC system in places like Alt Course, as well as starting to work with the Ministry of Justice to make the programme available via Launchpad. So we're starting to get experience of using the programme on a population-wide basis. But in 2020, we actually took that approach to the US. And since that time, we're across all the prisons in 19 State Department of Corrections, including North Carolina, where BB is based. But that's been a really useful insight as to how you can kind of broaden out access to the interventions, as well as working across multiple county and city jails in the US. So we've got lots of experience working with different populations in different types of correctional settings. And as a result of that, we were cited by the United Nations last year in terms of example of best practice when it comes to sort of digital rehabilitation, which we'll describe in a bit more detail shortly. So as a result of our experience and the research that we've undertaken, we've tried to get external validation during that time. So we've had the programs fully CSAP accredited, which in itself is an interesting process because it's the only digital interventions to have gone through that process. And that is for prisons and probation service as well. But equally, we've had the programs approved as an effective regime intervention by HMPPS, which reassures governors and other sort of stakeholders within the prison setting of the integrity the program carries. We've also had the programs from a health perspective endorsed by NICE around behavioural change. We have had the programs in the past accredited by OCR to actually try and broaden out access via Virtual Campus. And we've also started to look at other territories where we're also looking at the prison system within Canada as we speak. So we've tried to get that kind of external validation whilst doing the research in the background.
So we'll just tell you a bit more about the programme now. So Breaking Free, it's essentially digital CBT, but we have included a number of other proven therapeutic approaches in the programme. So things like relapse prevention, harm reduction, mindfulness, motivational enhancement. And the programme's designed to help people to get into recovery and make progress in their recovery from substance use disorders. The content of the programme is underpinned by a six-domain CBT model that we call the lifestyle balance model. And we've done lots of research over the past 13, 14 years, looking at things like acceptability of the programme in various settings, efficacy and outcomes, and also the mechanisms of action of the programme as well. So in other words, trying to understand how the programme exerts its clinical effects. And we've structured our research programme around the UK Medical Research Council guidance for the development and evaluation of complex interventions. So from our database, we have a big backend database that captures data from all of the people that use our program who consent for their data to be used for research purposes. And we can see from our backend database that we've provided support to about 250,000 people in UK and US prisons and jails, which is pretty astounding, really. We publish all of our research in peer-reviewed academic journals. I think we've got 44 studies published to date, but that number is always going up, which is fantastic. So we work in collaboration with colleagues from the UK, the US and Canada. But just to give you some of the headline outcomes from the research we've published over the years, we've demonstrated that in both community and correctional settings, the programme supports people to experience reductions in their drug and alcohol use and also the severity of their substance dependence. Because the programme also contains content that is for helping people with their mental health challenges, we've also demonstrated that the programme does indeed help people to experience improvements in their mental health, but also their quality of life and their social functioning. And essentially what the programme has been shown to do is to help people to make progress in their recovery. And of course, we know that all of these things are key protective factors that promote desistance. So we're just going to run you through a few of the studies that we've published over the years with people who have engaged with the programme in prisons. So these are just some of the journal articles that we've published using data from our prison users. We've published a whole load of quantitative clinical outcome studies, so looking at things like substance dependence, quality of life, recovery progression, substance use. But one of the things that we're also really interested in doing is qualitative research. And we've done this qualitative research, not just in prisons, but also community settings as well. And it's really important when you're introducing a novel intervention, especially when it's digital, into a treatment system to understand the barriers to implementation and engagement, but also the facilitators as well. So we can really maximise engagement and also maximise clinical outcomes that people experience. And we always conduct our qualitative research, not just with service users, but also staff that are supporting those service users as well. So the first project we'll talk to you about is the Gateways project.
So this was the first time we actually got to do some research within the kind of prison environment. It was based on a project that was funded by the NHS England, effectively, in partnership with HMPPS. But the real focus of the programme was to look at continuity of care. So the Gateways project was, as it sounds, in terms of looking at that kind of through the gate provision to see how we could support individuals with substance use difficulties transitioning back to the community and what kind of additional support and gains were required to kind of maintain their recovery following release. So we worked across about sort of 10 prisons in the northwest of England. Equally, what was really interesting at that point was it was our first experience of using the program via virtual campus. So that had lots of kind of interesting experiences from it in terms of healthcare, sort of substance use staff and program staff going into the education department for the first time and starting to foster kind of cross-departmental working. What was really interesting was that the actual sort of research itself really did focus in terms of being a mixed methods approach, but it was stuff that we hadn't sort of experienced before, like having to take a dictaphone into the prison, so having to get kind of permission for that process. But having sort of done interviews with sort of 26 different stakeholders, it was interesting to kind of get their experiences from the staff implementing the programme and overseeing the projects through to the individual residents using the programme, as well as kind of looking at the back end database to sort of see what kind of patterns and trends we were seeing through the sort of quantitative data. And what was quite interesting for us, bearing in mind this was pre-pandemic, so there was lots of kind of sort of perceptions as to how sort of digital would be received by residents in the prison setting. But also what we found from staff as well was their kind of initial trepidation to actually using digital and their kind of preconceived ideas about how people would respond to it. A lot of bearing in mind that people are trained to be non-judgmental and to not stereotype and stigmatize, there was a lot of perception around how digitally how people would struggle with using kind of computers and the internet more generally. What we did find was that actually lots of individuals were using and engaging with the program that wouldn't normally traditionally engage with other kind of group interventions. And so the staff kind of liked that because it meant they were engaging other individuals into the treatment system that they hadn't been able to previously. And I think there's something about using different treatment modalities to engage different individuals. But equally, what we found was that the people really responded well to the fact that the content was specific to the prison environment and specific to substance use, so that it resonated with them, that it wasn't just something that was parachuted in from the community to fit within the prison context. And the key crucial thing based on the project, the Gateways project, was the fact that we were able to demonstrate that continuity of care. So people transitioning back to the community following release, their work was being ported across to them and they're actually able to stay on that recovery journey. Statistically, what we saw was there was significant improvements across the board in terms of reductions, not just in terms of substance use, but also underlying substance dependence, as well as improvements across mental health, specifically anxiety, depression, quality of life and biopsychosocial functioning.
Okay, so we'll just introduce you to the first study that we did using data provided by prison residents in the United States. And this was with a group of people using our program at Ohio Department of Rehabilitation and Corrections. So in May 2020, just after the pandemic kicked off, Breakerfew was added as content to the secure tablets that ODRC were delivering across the state. And what these were intended to do is to allow prison residents to access SUD treatments, substance use treatment, during the COVID-19 restrictions, when, of course, everybody was confined to their rooms pretty much all the time for safety reasons. But what this particular project allowed people to do is to access Breaking Free from within their room. This study used a within subjects design to examine changes over time on the measures that Glyn just previously outlined. So substance use independence, quality of life, mental health. And we were looking at changes over time from baseline to post-engagement for people who'd engaged with Breaking Free at ODRC. So we used our back-end data from the back-end database for this. In total, 2,187 prison residents participated, and they engaged with Breaking Free between May 2020 and September 2021. In this particular study, we were actually focusing on people who were using the program to address their methamphetamine use. That's something that we've not really been able to look at using our UK data, just given not many people present services with difficulties around methamphetamine use. And obviously, there are many links between methamphetamine use and offending. And ODRC provided us with approval to conduct this research back in May of 2021. So what we found when we looked at the baseline data from all the participants were very high rates of criminogenic risk factors, which is probably unsurprising. So issues around things like work and education problems, unstable accommodation, financial difficulties, but also interpersonal difficulties as well. Some challenges around risk taking and aggressive behaviour, and also some challenges with mental health in terms of paranoid thinking and just general poor health as well. But what we did find is when people engage with Breaking Free, they experience significant reductions in their self-reported methamphetamine dependence, but also significant improvements in all of those other outcomes. So depression and anxiety, psychosocial functioning, quality of life. And we did find that the criminogenic risk factors that were reported at baseline did seem to be associated with outcomes. So although everybody tended to do quite fare quite well when they were using Breaking Free, perhaps for some of those individuals that were maybe clinically a bit more complex at baseline, they maybe didn't experience the same degree of improvement. So that maybe indicates where we might be able to provide additional support to those people who present with greater clinical complexity at baseline. And we also found a dose response. So for a lot of the studies that we've conducted over the years in both community and prison settings, we find that the number of strategies that people complete in the program is associated with outcomes. So in other words, the more of the strategies people complete, the more times they complete them, the better their outcomes overall. So we'll just move on to another study we conducted here in the UK. And this is where we were delivering Breaking Free via secure laptops in a couple of prisons here in the Northwest.
Yeah, so following on from the Gateways project, one of the real challenges there with accessing virtual campus was the real basic barriers, the logistics of getting the men and women to the education department, getting them logged on to virtual campus. It was quite a laborious and challenging process. So following the pandemic, HMPPS funded tele recovery laptops and visionable laptops, which were piloted in 12 prisons across the northeast and northwest of England, with a view to reducing some of those barriers. So rather than working in education, taking the laptops to the wings or to other parts of the prison where there was good connectivity, bearing in mind all the challenges of sort of phone blockers and sort of, you know, some prisons being out in very rural areas, big thick walls, lots of that, those kind of challenges to overcome. So there was a real focus in terms of identifying where in the prison there was kind of good connectivity. What we really found from this project was that we were really kind of looking to gain insights into the experiences of staff through the implementation process. Because, again, some of the staff were still kind of reluctant in terms of using technology and laptops compared to what they've been doing traditionally with flip charts, pen and paper over the past kind of however long. And so what we really wanted to do is to kind of undertake interviews to kind of better understand some of those kind of processes and barriers and facilitators to the implementation of the program via these secure laptops. So what was really helpful was kind of realizing that a lot of the barriers to implementing this program was very similar to what we'd experienced with virtual campus. So in that sense, we had lots of learnings that we could draw upon straight away. Again, identifying whereabouts in the prison there was sort of decent connectivity. And actually, there is kind of, when you bear in mind the amount of smartphones and that are being used within prisons, you know, where you can find connectivity, the sessions would work really well. There was a real focus in terms of trying to do this work on the kind of incentivized substance-free living, the you know, today's kind of drug-free wings, and kind of being able to have that ability to move around with the laptops to kind of run the sessions wherever was most optimal. What was really challenging was obviously the environment. It's not the most conducive sort of environment to run kind of internet and Wi-Fi based services. But that being said, that has also led to lots of learnings in terms of looking at different SIM cards that could be more kind of responsive. It's fair to say the institution locally as well as centrally, there is that really risk adverse culture. So we've had to do lots of kind of DPIA sessions, looking at threat risk assessments, looking at the whole security aspect, including on the ground where the kind of laptops were being implemented. The biggest issue, though, for this particular project was the under-resourcing of staffing, services firefighting due to kind of a lack of trained and skilled staff to deliver the programs. And the actual, some for a number of individuals, as Bibi described in her presentation, the kind of levels of literacy for some of the individuals that were being identified. And of course, through using this process, we would see this as a way of kind of helping to bridge that and support those individuals to become more digitally literate. So it has resulted in a lot of kind of recommendations for best practice, particularly in terms of getting support from leadership in terms of implementing programs like this to ensure that staff on the ground kind of understand the importance and how this can help sort of transform sort of delivery of interventions. Equally, to do the signal mapping and going around the prison to find the most optimal places to run the sessions, and just to offer that ongoing support for staff to make sure that they recognise they are crucial to this process and to make sure that they're supported, particularly given the kind of high churn of staff that we've been seeing, particularly during this project.
So the last study we'll talk to you about is another quantitative study using our backend database. But what we've done here is use the data from our UK prison residents and our US prison residents to start doing some comparisons, because there are quite different delivery models that are employed across those two territories. So here in the UK, as Lynn was describing, breaking free is delivered via either secure desktop, secure laptops, or on the virtual campus in staff facilitated group sessions. Whereas in the US, because all of these secure tablets are available, it means that prison residents can access the programme independently without staff support. So they're two quite different delivery models. So what we wanted to do really is compare these two groups of prison residents in terms of their baseline data. So the measures that we collect via our assessment, things like socio-demographic factors, the problem substances that they reported, clinical complexity, criminogenic risk factors. But we also wanted to compare outcomes for these two groups of prison residents as well, just to try and understand how these two different delivery models might impact on clinical outcomes. So we had a total of 1,296 UK prison residents and 18,837 US prison residents, which I think immediately shows you just what you can achieve when you do have things like secure laptops that can be delivered across an entire population. So we did find some differences between the two groups of prison residents in their baseline clinical and psychosocial factors. So we did actually find greater clinical complexity in the UK group. We do discuss this in a bit more detail in the paper. So if anyone would like access to that, please do let us know and we can send it over to you. But there were some interesting differences, which we won't go into too much detail around here because we don't really have the time. But what we did find is that because the UK prison residents were supported by staff to use Breaking Free, they did demonstrate higher levels of engagement with the programme. So they completed more strategies in the programme. They completed more what we call progress check assessments, which is where they kind of check in and do a follow-up assessment. And there were also group differences in terms of clinical outcomes as well. So both groups demonstrated significant clinical improvements in terms of substance dependence, mental health, biopsychosocial functioning and quality of life. But there were some slight differences between the groups in terms of some of the other clinical outcomes that we collect. And again, all of that information is reported in the paper. So just to finish, I'll hand over to Glyn, who's going to give a summary of some of the lessons that we've learned from the research that we've done through the delivery of Breaking Free in prison settings.
Yeah, so it's been a really interesting journey because things have evolved massively, particularly since the pandemic, where there seems to be a lot more receptiveness to kind of introducing sort of digital resources into sort of prisons. One thing that has been really challenging is the kind of bureaucracy process in terms of doing the research. So the fact that we have had to get multiple approvals, there's a lot of gatekeepers within this process. So when you're wanting to sort of engage with people in prison, you are having to go through sort of central national HMPPS, as well as the NHS, but also at a local level, going to prison governors, sometimes drug strategy leads, and then even down to the kind of people who are engaged in the treatment from a substance use perspective. In a lot of prisons, we're having to do that with prime providers and then with the subcontracted substance use providers. But equally, we know that it's really important to get the right approvals in place. And so it's about kind of planning for that and making sure that that's all factored in from the outset. Also, working with the staff in prisons has to be particularly sensitively managed. The reason for that is that staff are really struggling at the moment, particularly on the ground, There's lots of kind of firefighting going on. There's really sort of challenges in terms of just operating on a normal sort of day-to-day basis. So them having to kind of facilitate a sort of research project is also quite challenging. Equally, what we tend to find is that a lot of the services that we're working with are kind of really struggling, and therefore we're not necessarily going to be a priority. And then there's the really kind of simple practicalities, the sort of logistical challenges of working within the prison environment, getting the men and women to move around to interview rooms can be particularly challenging, especially for those individuals that may be working during the day, have visits and so forth. Equally, for lots of individuals, as with lots of community-based research, there's often people who don't attend for various reasons. And so it's kind of trying to work with that, particularly on given the amount of time and resource it takes to go to prisons to undertake the research, and having to roll with the kind of prison regime, with the lockdowns that's happening. Home house at the moment having no gas, which means it's completely shut down at the moment. So there's these things that you just can't plan for, which is something we've kind of also had to get used to. And of course, there's always challenges in terms of the prison regime just being very, very unpredictable.
Okay, so we'll finish there. I don't know, Vic, if you'll be sharing slides, but we've provided some references as well. So if anybody does want to access the slides and access some of the research we've cited, then please do. Thank you.
Oh, thanks both. That was really insightful. Thank you. In terms of your insights on the kind of clinical outcomes and impact, as well as the criminogenic detail that you provided, but also, Glyn, at the end when you talked about the prison setting and delivering a service either on or offline, right, is challenging. So thanks for those insights, and I think that links back nicely with some of the things that Bibi was saying. There's lots of chat in there. You might want to take a look, guys, and we'll come back to some of these topics. So thank you both. That was brilliant. And the trajectory of your work is extensive. And your point about how, you know, when Bibi said this about that, you know, these challenges still often remain the same. So thank you. Rob, I think we're now ready for Carolyn's presentation. For folks that are listening that may have joined late, Carolyn can't be with us today. She's based in Sydney, Australia. So she's kindly provided a pre-record of her presentation. She's done some fascinating research, particularly around remote hearings. So we're going to get a different perspective here in relation to obviously sort of the legal end of all of this. So yeah, I think Rob is quietly preparing the presentation. Yeah. From
that's
Carolyn.
Okay with me. Yes.
No pressure.
they've changed the way that you find the files, and it's become where is the that it used to be a really simple way of accessing the files. So
okay,
just stop the share again. Has anybody got a hint of share screen? Share file, and it used to take you to the
the item.
Yeah, and where's that gone? So let me. I'll open it in a window, and then I'll go to the window.
Yeah, thank you.
Wait, pause that.
Wrong's gone.
Yeah, I'm just looking. We've had some really interesting. We've had some really interesting comments and questions from our listeners or viewers today. And I think, yeah, there's a theme, and also it's interesting, you know, how much people do know about, you know, people's entitlements to digital resources and services in our prisons. And certainly we've all had insight how varied. Here she is.
Is welcome, that ready for you? Yes.
Welcome,
okay.
So Carolyn.
I began to panic. So let me find how to press play.
Yeah. Thank you.
Hang on.
And also Associate Professor in Law at the University of Sydney Law School. Before I begin, I'd like to acknowledge the traditional custodians of the lands on which the University of Sydney now stands, the Gadigal people of the Eora Nation. Thank you for inviting me to speak briefly about my research into technologies in criminal justice, and I'm sorry that the timing of the event means that this is a pre-recording. But certainly please feel free to contact me should you wish to discuss any of the issues that I raised today. So by way of background, first of all, I've been researching technologies in criminal justice since 2011. I primarily have focused on the use of audio-visual links, or AVL, video links or video conferencing, but I've also researched other technologies in criminal justice, including artificial intelligence, police body-worn cameras, as well as smart prisons. Today, I'm going to focus on my very recently completed national study that was funded by the Australian Government. It's called the Digital Criminal Justice Project, Vulnerability and the Digital Subject. But given the limited time, please refer to the project website for all the details in relation to this particular project. But just by way of very quick overview, The project has been a national project, and its objective was to empirically evaluate the interrelationship between digitalized criminal justice and vulnerability, and to ask a couple of questions, including in what ways do remote communication technologies, such as audiovisual links, how do they assist or perhaps disadvantage vulnerable individuals in the criminal justice system? Building on this empirical inquiry, the project has sought to further conceptualise the notion of digital vulnerability, being a framework for understanding the new social solutions as well as potential harms that may arise when vulnerable individuals use remote communication technologies to access various parts of the criminal justice system. I'll just give a quick overview of my research methodology. The project's findings have been based on my original empirical research data from 175 fieldwork interviews and surveys with Australian judges, magistrates, defence lawyers, prosecutors and affiliated criminal justice professionals such as witness intermediaries and witness assistance service professionals. I also undertook content analysis of relevant case law and legislation. The interviews were conducted across all Australian capital cities as well as select regional and remote locations, as you'll see on the following slides. I have just very recently published a book that encapsulates all my findings from this particular study. It's actually an open access book, meaning you can download it for free. And hopefully within that book, it brings out the significance of this particular study. So with the use of remote communication technologies rapidly increasing and being normalised in courts and in practice, this project has sought to offer fresh and timely empirical insights into the complexities of remote communication technologies when working with both vulnerable witnesses as well as vulnerable defendants. So as the criminal justice disproportionately impacts such vulnerable individuals, there is a pressing need to generate a critical understanding of and deep engagement with vulnerability in the digitalized legal environment. The knowledge generated by this study is relevant to policies and protocols regarding justice innovation, and also in understanding, firstly, how digitalized justice impacts equitable access to justice, and secondly, how to deliver digitalized justice while minimizing negative impacts. Some of my key findings will appear on the next couple of slides. Here are just some very general findings, and I probably just covered some of these points in my earlier comments. I'll now move to the next slide in relation to key findings. Basically, my studies key findings have been sharply delineated between vulnerable witnesses versus vulnerable defendants. Now, first of all, in relation to vulnerable witnesses, so they actually include people who would be called complainants in my jurisdiction, or victims, as well as prosecution witnesses. So regarding these vulnerable witnesses, there are tangible benefits stemming from remote participation, for example, during victim conferencing or during court matters. And the benefits are particularly in shielding these people from the stress, intimidation, and trauma of the adversarial courtroom. For these individuals, my study has found that video links are what I call techniques of mitigation that ameliorate vulnerabilities. They enhance recall. They facilitate the best evidence, the presentation of that best evidence, the most coherent evidence, and therefore enhance access to justice. I do actually find also some problems for this group of people. So my study does point to some potential forensic disadvantages for the prosecution case when a vulnerable witness appears via a pre-recorded or remote testimony, as the emotional weight may be sanitized by technological mediation. In relation to my findings on vulnerable defendants, remote modes of legal conferencing, as well as court appearance, online court appearance, can be very positive in avoiding prison court transportation and disruptions to prison accommodation and prison schedules. Nevertheless, many defense lawyers in particular who I interviewed and surveyed emphasize that remote modes are not suitable replacements for face-to-face legal meetings, particularly when we're discussing sensitive matters that require confidentiality and privacy. Remote modes can also impede the identification of the so-called markers of vulnerability in defendants, and it can basically undermine the ability to provide informed legal advice and raise available defences and mitigating factors. More broadly, video links were perceived, especially by defence lawyers, as inhibiting human connection, communication, engagement and participation in criminal process, leading to vulnerable defendants perhaps having a muted level of comprehension. So there's very much these issues in relation to confidentiality, connection, communication, and comprehension. So even though vulnerable defendants often share the same attributes as vulnerable witnesses, my study has found that defendants' vulnerabilities are insufficiently addressed and or often exacerbated by these technologies. So because video links can compound the vulnerabilities of remote defendants or online defendants, my study has found that they can be conceptualized as techniques of intensification that can generate barriers to justice rather than access to justice. Courts and lawyers must be aware of the need to tailor the technological experience for vulnerable defendants. I think what's also potentially relevant for your event today is to also look at some of my key theoretical findings in relation to the theory of digital vulnerability. My study has contributed new insights into this notion of digital vulnerability as a framework for conceptually capturing the convergence of technologies and vulnerability in criminal procedure. With this understanding, video links were found to act paradoxically in both potentially mitigating or intensifying vulnerabilities. So I very much sort of find these sort of dualities that the technologies in certain circumstances can support people's resilience. At the same time, for other people, it depletes their resilience. It can humanize and dehumanize. The technology can connect and disconnect people from effective participation, comprehension, and communication. In my next couple of slides, I've just got a couple of examples of my survey and interview data. I'm sort of running out of time, so I would highly recommend that you have a look at my project's website as well as download my book that's for free. But I'll just run through a couple of the slides as well that might be relevant for your event. You can see on this slide some examples of some of the problems with using video link technologies for vulnerable defendants and how they can often appear on screen being very distracted, blurry, disengaged, and disassociated. I think some of this data is quite relevant in relation to questions of being conscious of the needs of rehabilitation as well. But how do we have rehabilitation? How do we bring that issue in a situation which can become very dehumanized, very impersonal as well? So there are some problems when you've got someone, a client, appearing only on video link, that they can perhaps not express their remorse as closely or as carefully as they would in person, and that can perhaps reflect on their ability to be rehabilitated, and perhaps therefore it can have some outcomes in relation to whether they are granted parole or not. Again, as mentioned before, there are problems with the technology in engagement and participation, and that's because many people find the technology disengaging, disempowering, and feeling that they're just a powerless pawn in a game of chess. Again, some comments here in relation to basically defendants feeling that they become even more vulnerable because they lose meaningful opportunity to interact with their lawyers during criminal process. Of course, where people are actually in the same shared space, there is that notion of the continual feedback loop between the lawyer and client, and that is very much missing, usually during video link type procedures. And again, in terms of comprehension, as I've mentioned before, it's very difficult for people actually physically in the same shared space for any criminal procedure to understand what's going on. But there is a whole new level of challenge when technologies, communication technologies, also come into that particular process. The judicial perspectives for my study, I think, are particularly poignant as well. And a number of Supreme Court justices, as well as district court justices and magistrates, were supportive of the technologies, but also critical at the same time. And they thought, especially for defendants, that we've probably learnt the lesson that justice is best done in person. I also gathered a lot of data in relation to future visions. So knowing that we have these technologies and obviously we want them to continue to develop, And as I've got here on the slide, despite there are many concerns in relation to perhaps digitalized justice being second-rate justice, participants broadly supported expanding the use of and the infrastructure surrounding these types of technologies. But if we're going to do that, we need to be doing it in a thinking and intentional way. We'll leave my presentation at this particular point in time. I've written a lot about this over the years, so here's just a summary of my publications as well. But I wish you all the very best for your event, and thank you for inviting me.
Okay. Thank you, Carolyn. It's a shame she can't be here today. Could I kindly ask Sarah, Glyn and Bibi to join us for a little roundup and chat about today's session? I've certainly got a question that I would like to put to all three of you, if you don't mind. And that's around, I think what's mapped across for me today, the session is about the human work and the human impact of around this topic. And I'm hoping that we would extend this. And I think certainly some of the questions are about the human end of all of this, not just the technology. And I'm just wondering if you've got any thoughts on what organisational conditions are needed to prevent technology from, you know, increasing things like inequality, vulnerability, as Carolyn carefully defined for us, surveillance, and things like staff burnout, and that may well extend to, you know, justice-involved people. I just want to know what you might think, what organisational conditions are needed to prevent technology from increasing things like inequality. Have you got any thoughts, Glyn?
There's some really basic stuff, because the one challenge we've always found is in terms of the commissioning of services, because without the resourcing, prisons are always the last to, you know, when it comes to government spending, healthcare, schools, prisons, we know what's going to win and what's going to lose. And when you see the kind of prison crisis that, you know, I was studying 30 years ago and seems to be the same today, if not worse than what it was then, we've seen the rest of the world kind of really kind of transform and adopt technology. And prisons have just been at such a lag behind that. And yet, with the under-resourcing today of staffing, meaning that, you know, prisoners are, or people within prison are banged up for so much of the day that when they are out of their rooms or their cells, they're kicking off, majorly causing more issues. And technology, like we've seen with the in-cell resourcing and technology, it doesn't just help with some of those kind of bureaucratic processes in terms of, you know, ordering food, booking visits. But there's that real kind of ability, the agency that somebody has, the fact they can actually decide what they're doing with their own time, you know, that they've got some control over their day-to-day life when they are banged up, for us just shows the real value, particularly in what we've seen from the US, where, yeah, the tablets, devices and content is different to what we have on the outside, but they're so much more advanced than what we've got in the UK. You know, people can order films and you know, sort of music and have more of a kind of normalised stay, as well as kind of additional, you know, access to educational resourcing and stuff like that. It just helps to create more of a normalised thing, but there's all the basics that you need there, you know. The devices, connectivity, staff to facilitate it.
And it might be worth just telling you about our most recent research, which we didn't actually include in this presentation because it's not been submitted for publication yet. But we've actually been looking at kind of predictors of inequity when, or inequities when engaging with Breaking Free. So we have found that there are perhaps certain groups of people who may find it a bit more challenging to engage with a digital program like ours, certainly without staff support, talking about that human element. So what we're trying to understand at the minute is how we can provide, you know, prisons and other kind of sort of organisations, environments that are delivering our programme with kind of anticipatory guidance so that they can identify who might need a bit more support, because we want to make access to our programme and the outcomes that people experience equitable. And that means that some people will need a bit more handholding, whether it's to do with, you know, actually engage with the technology because they've got lower levels of digital literacy, or maybe it's that, you know, they are, you know, experiencing greater levels of clinical complexity, concurrent mental health challenges, maybe difficulties with literacy, you know, all of these sorts of things. So we do need to ensure that we are using that human element to target that additional support to those people that need it, so that everyone can benefit equally from this digital tech. But it's very challenging because then obviously you're trying to encourage places like prisons to ensure that their staff have all the time to kind of get on board and understand the technology.
Thank you, Sarah and Glyn. What are your insights then in supporting staff? I think all three presentations that we've had today have talked about upskilling, appropriate conditions. Carolyn talked about, you know, having specially designed places for these remote hearings. In your case, it could be in cell or within group settings or other situations. And Bibi touched on that as well. Any thoughts on that?
Yeah, if I could take a first stab at that. So I think the biggest issue that we encountered was that it was often the higher ups who made a decision unilaterally without talking to their staff first. And so what we saw was a little bit of almost like pushback, right? Being like, oh, but we weren't asked and we're the ones who have to deal with it, right? And I think making those decisions on a human basis, right? So what's the point of bringing these technologies in the first place and then having a conversation with the staff first before that decision is made and talking about, okay, what are the repercussions, right? And what kinds of support do staff need? And just like Sarah and Glyn said, here in the States, any and all prisons are understaffed. So they're already dealing with a lot to begin with. So coming back to that idea of, you know, bringing something else in, an additional burden, that's often how it was perceived by the staff that we talked about. And so I think really making sure that these decisions are not made top down, but that there is a dialogue going on before these decisions are made. And then the implementation will work a lot better too.
Yeah. So that's certainly key. And certainly the work that I've been doing, that this is reiterated time and time again, that the role of staff and support structures, both in prisons and community settings, are really important. Something that I think both of your presentations, I don't think Carolyn touched upon that, and I'd be interested, you talked about research, that certainly some of, you know, the decision making around implementation, that decision, we're going to go for this and we're going to introduce these services, is around evidence bases. Your challenges of collecting evidence, right? And it's a chicken and egg, isn't it? It's we need the research, we need the evidence, we need the analysis and the data to support informed decision making around, say, implementation or pilots, for example. And how challenging, both certainly in prison settings, but also in community settings. And you talked about that transition, certainly Bibi and Sarah and Glyn, you talked about that transition to community. Have you got any insights about how say, people that are listening, any advice around, you know, follow-up studies, for example? And we know Sarah's face and Bibi. it's a real challenge, isn't it? There's so many hoops, but also
You just have to be very persistent. And I mean, many years ago, we did attempt to get approval to combine health data and justice data to kind of link the two and demonstrate, you know, the kind of broader outcomes, not just in terms of substance use and all the data we collect, but also things like, you know, recidivism and all the stuff that the Ministry of Justice wants to understand and wants evidence for. But because it's so complex, because of obviously, you know, understandably very strict data protection security laws that we have now here in the UK and across the EU with GDPR. So it's not just challenging to kind of get into the prison and do your own research yourself, but when you know that there's additional data available that you could potentially draw upon, it's also really challenging to get access to that data in order to answer the questions that, you know, organisations like the Ministry of Justice want us to answer. But yeah, it's difficult. I think Glyn's, I can see him.
It's also trying to be very cute so that when somebody's coming out of prison, they've got their discharge grant, they're going back to same environment, same friends, family, life's going to be very different to what it was when you're interviewing somebody within the prison environment. So if you can identify a service in the community that you know they're going to be linking in with, you've got a much greater chance of maintaining that relationship and kind of continuing. But at the same time, again, depending on the purpose of the research and the focus, when people are wanting to see statistics around recidivism, having those kind of conversations post-release, you know, if people are maintaining their sort of rehabilitation and haven't resorted back to reoffending, brilliant. But it's also quite challenging in terms of where you kind of go with that if people are, you know, because it's one thing sort of ending up back in the criminal justice system, but if you're also looking at you know, reoffending generally, it's just an interesting kind of ethical thing. But targeting organizations where you know people will be linking into, and when you look at approved premises, how much they're struggling, how under-resourced they are, you know, it is like the Wild West, and therefore not necessarily the most conducive environments for helping people to kind of move on with their lives, but equally building those relationships with community resources. Yeah,
I want to plug my colleague's research. Dr. Hyunjin So from University of Kansas is doing a intervention study right now, and it's a quantitative study, which, you know, we don't have a lot of, and it's a really... it's got wraparound services, but it's specifically also focusing on those digital skills. And I believe they start working with people during incarceration, and then they continue work with them in the first 6 months post-release. And so she's been collecting data for a couple of years now. So I'm like burning to see what she's found. I'm like, just publish your data. Definitely keep an eye out for that, because I think that's going to be one of those first studies on digital literacy, generally speaking, not in a specific context, that we're going to see some really interesting outcomes. Although I don't think this is a randomized controlled trial, so I don't think she has a control group where they don't get that training. But it'll still be interesting to see what comes out of that. I'm going to put her name in the chat as well, in case anyone wants to.
Her work's fantastic, isn't it, Bibi? I know I'm conscious of time, but I just want to end, because we have lots of international listeners today. And congratulations, both of you, for doing cross-national studies and a comparative study, Sarah and Glyn, as well. Well done for doing that. That's brilliant. I'm just interested about how, and you talked about the differences of context, Sarah, around sort of UK and US. And there is a temptation, isn't there, that we're that the the evidence base within this space is slowly growing, but perhaps not at the pace that certain justice organisations would like. And I'm just interested in what aspects of your evidence do you think would travel well, or your practice? What aspects could other countries or jurisdictions perhaps take from that? And I know that's a really provocative question, and I'm anticipating you may say, well, it's a difficult thing to answer, but I think I'm just interested in some of those uniform that there is disadvantage, there is inequality, there is vulnerability,
there's real need. I mean, just from a Breaking Free perspective, every country that we introduce in Breaking Free to, substance use is a huge issue, particularly within the prison environment. And healthcare and treatment for individuals with those difficulties, whether they resulted, their sentence result was a result of their drug and alcohol use, or they are just drug users and alcohol users anyway, the need is massive. And the resourcing is there, and substance use isn't Monday to Friday, 9 to 5, and that in-person provision is available. Mm-hmm. So being able to provide resources and support and intervention, evenings, weekends, even if it's there to augment and complement that in-person provision, for us is really important, but also to have something that will provide that re-entry, that reintegration provision as well, is critical. And that is translatable to other territories. The real challenge remains the IT infrastructure to facilitate it in the first place. Mm-hmm. And this, I appreciate in the US, it varies from state to state, but there's some amazing advances over there that certainly we could benefit from here in the UK, let alone other parts of the world.
I think the other thing I'd say to follow up on that as well is, I think in some contexts, digital is seen as kind of what we would refer to as a panacea. So there's this kind of misconception that if you just introduce this new technology into a system, whatever it might be, that it's all of a sudden going to solve all these problems and everyone's going to, you know, experience all of these gains in their recovery from their substance use. Yeah. But just to go back to that, you know, what we were talking about earlier about the human element, definitely when you're working with people that, you know, their lives are so complex. So many people that are involved in the criminal justice system, you know, are traumatized people. They're struggling with their mental health, socioeconomic disadvantages, you know, a whole raft of different difficulties. And so you can't just expect someone who's got a life that's that complex and challenging to sit down in front of a piece of technology and just use it. Some people can. And we've come across people that we've worked with in prisons that are so great at using our program. They're helping all of their peers to engage with it. I've been lucky enough to run a few group sessions a few years ago before COVID. You know, so there are people that are obviously highly digitally literate, and drawing upon them as kind of peer supporters, we found is really helpful, not just in prison settings, but community as well. But just really taking into account the challenges that the population of people we work with have faced for their entire lives, and being sensitive to that and providing that human support where it's needed. Definitely.
Can I just comment on the US versus the UK? I'm CEO of Unilink, Francis Toy, and we provide the self-service in many prisons, all the private prisons and quite a few of the public prisons in the UK now. And I'll just say, in contrast between the UK and the US, the US has been driven by a lot of companies who are charging large amounts of money for these tablets. And the UK, rightly, I think, hasn't wanted to go down these routes, which frankly are, I think, quite bad. They are charging prisoners so much. It was a case a few years ago when, you know, a prisoner would get into prison and it would immediately, the family would get a bill for $200 for things that were being provided to this prisoner. And we don't do that in the UK. And I think it's absolutely right that we don't. Mm-hmm. And there is gradually becoming more and more not just, as you say, meals ordering and applications and food and shopping and so on, which are all coming. And I think a majority of prisoners have that now, but entertainment is coming. And we are trying very hard to make it free at the point of the use to the prisoner, which is really important because we're not dealing with people whom spending a lot of money is an option, quite honestly. And frankly, I think the American system generally is usury on the prisoners. I think it's absolutely immoral and quite appalling. But you might see it on the outside as, oh, they have lots of tablets. Well, they do, but there are strong commercial reasons why they're being exploited. That's what I wanted to say.
I couldn't agree more. That's what when I mentioned that in my initial talk, that I could talk for hours about the prison tablets. That's exactly what I was referring to. Thank you.
I wanted that talk with you for hours.
Anytime.
Thank you. Bibi, have you got a final comment for us today?
I honestly now just want to talk about prison tablets. But yeah. I do fully agree with Francis's point that you know, yes, it might be slower in the UK, but I really agree that the point of making it free, like I said in the very beginning of my talk, the people who are incarcerated are also the ones who are most vulnerable in society to begin with. So you know, ideally, we'd love it fast and furious, right? But it has to be done the right way. And so, you know, people here in the US, families are going into debt to make sure that they can talk to their loved ones on the inside. And that's just not okay. So again, it all comes back to this human first perspective, right? Why are we doing this? Who are we doing this for? And you know, what's the bigger outcome that we're looking for?
And ethical and careful and considered and informed and as much as possible evidence-based. My plea would be to enable good people like Bibi and Sarah and Glyn to do their research in these contexts and support that. Thank you, everyone, including Carolyn. I'm sorry she's not here today. And as Rob has put in the chat, we have our next roundtable on the 17th of March. And it's an opportunity for people to further reflect on what's been presented today in the webinar. And we will have a number of guests involved in that discussion. So thank you to our presenters. I'm sure if we could all do a round of applause for our presenters, that's great. And thank you so much for your valuable time. And to colleagues joining us from around the globe, it's just amazing. Technology enables us to do that, right? And we can connect and have these really important discussions and hear about the important work that's helping inform good services, right? Thank you, everybody.
Just before you finish, Vic,
yes?
Just to say on that, well, the topic that Francis and Bibi was just well articulating, there's a really good film called The 13th, which was on Netflix. I'm not sure if it still is, but it's The 13th, and it describes the
prison industrial complex, is it?
Yeah, exactly, and the challenge of lots of those companies have created, but it's an extremely good film.
Ah, I've not seen that yet. Thank you so much for those insights, everyone. I will bid you all farewell, and we'll see you all again, hopefully, on the 17th of March. Take care, everyone.
Thanks, everyone.
Thank you.
Bye.
You have been listening to the INCJ podcast, conversations about international criminal justice. Find out more, go to our website at criminaljusticenetwork.net or follow us on Twitter at INTCJ Network.